yeah, it's much more important.
Thank you.
You kill more people.
Thank you for coming. We're going to open the informational meeting portion of today's meeting of the Veterans and Emergency Services Committee. And I'm going to make us an adjustment on our agenda. And we're going to begin with the Port of Newport request for emergency assistance in the interest of some individuals' timing needs. And so I'd like to invite Don Mann from the Port of Newport. And are you bringing your cohort there up with you? Or?
Two of them.
Okay.
Two.
And I will let you do the introductions. Let me tell you, in terms of timing, Paul Evans from the governor's office needs to leave at 1:20. So I'm going to give you about 10 minutes to get into the presentation, and I may ask you to pause so that we can get his input before he has to leave. I don't want to miss that. And if anyone in the room who is not an emergency provider who absolutely has to have it on, could you please turn your cell phones off? They do interfere with the equipment here. At which point I will check mine to see if it's on silent or off here.
So I got it on please, vibrate, so I better turn it off.
That, now, yeah, you particularly who are sitting at that table need to turn yours off. Thank you very much for everyone's cooperation. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'd like to introduce our President of our Port Commission, Jenny Gilbridge, and also Craig Totten, who is a civil engineer with KPFF Engineering, and they can answer all the tough political and technical questions.
Great. Thank you.
My name is Don Mann. I'm the general manager of the Port of Newport. Representative Cowan and other members of the committee, thank you for the time today. And I'd like to give you a brief history on the project that we're talking about. The Port of Newport International Terminal was constructed by a private corporation in 1948 by sinking two World War II-era reinforced concrete cargo vessels. And they had names, the C.W. Paisley and the Franco's Hennebeek. The ship holds and space between the ship hull, once they were sunk, was filled with overburden and material from the bay to create the facility that we now have to serve for shipping wood products and other cargo from Newport and abroad. The Paisley, which is the subject of our request, was scuttled on the west end of our site, and I'm assuming I have some pictures here. The Paisley is the one you see in the front, and you can see the outline of the ship, and then the Hennebeek is under the warehouse. So you can't see the outline of the Hennebeek, but the ship, the concrete ship Paisley, you can see where we've already exposed some of the old cargo holds.
Okay.
And you can see the
excuse me, Don, could you move the microphone a little closer to you
sure.
So we pick up on the recording? Thank you.
And you can see the crack about two-thirds of the way back on the Paisley, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. When the Paisley was sunk, there was originally a starboard list to the, and you're looking at the starboard side, it's facing the bay, a starboard list of about 7 degrees, and it's now measured at about 13 degrees, which means the stern has rolled approximately 8 to 10 inches over the years. In the 1990s, a crack occurred at the stern, and that was the area that I was just talking about. And you can see a little bit closer in this photograph there. This ongoing movement allowed residual oil in the ship to leak into the bay, and it caused an oil spill back in 1996. The terminal was closed in 2001 to cargo movement due to continued structural failure and unsafe working conditions of the ship. There's a little closer view of that crack. You can see that the concrete ship, it's infested with rebar, and that's right now that's basically what's holding it together. The continued deterioration of the Paisley caused fuel from the starboard fuel tank to be hydraulically pumped into the bay into a day-use tank, which started to seep out into the deck of the ship. Interim removal actions were conducted throughout the year to remove fuel from the day tank to prevent a release into the environment. So we've been keeping track of that, and we've removed oil, approximately 8,000 gallons over the last year and a half. Total volume of remaining fuel in the starboard tank is undetermined. However, the analysis that we've done to date in the tank piping diagrams estimate a heel volume of about 2,000 gallons. And the heel volume is because the ship has rolled and the oil is trapped in a one section of that starboard fuel tank in the heel of that curve of the ship in that tank. The other two tanks that are adjacent to the fuel tank, I'm sure we have... there's a picture of the ship pushing out from the crack, and that's a picture looking down toward the inside of those vessels there in the warehouse is the Hennebeek. And I'll go back to these other pictures so you can continue to view the ugliness of that crack. The remaining tank volume, 44,000 gallons, where we've pumped the oil out of, is assumed to have contaminated water with hydrocarbons. In addition to the starboard fuel tank, the Paisley has a centerline and port fuel tank. Both tanks are filled with water, and they both are contaminated with hydrocarbon, so it's contaminated water and oil at this time. The process that we've been going through to date, in November of 2006, we passed a bond measure to prepare and repair our facility and rebuild a new terminal dock facility. The regulatory process for the project for the permits is ongoing, but the Paisley Hall is failing faster than the permit process is progressing. Funding assistance is needed to assist with immediate stabilization to stop the hull movement this winter. The movement and deterioration of the Paisley is not a perceived issue. It's an event in progress. Action needs to be taken as soon as possible to stabilize the ship and to minimize environmental damage. Present movement is attributed directly to normal tide exchange and river current and due to the age of the vessel. Federal and state regulatory agencies are aware of the urgency and the need for the terminal renovation project. The rapidly failing condition of the Paisley increases the magnitude of the situation to include the potential for loss of life, environmental and navigation hazards, and liability to the port. On May 20th, 2008, the Port of Newport Board of Commissioners declared by unanimous vote that an emergency exists and that the failing condition of the Paisley poses an immediate threat of potential loss of life and environment and navigation hazard. As a precautionary measure, the port has deployed an oil boom, containment boom around the Paisley, and I have to say at this point we had to remove that boom just about a week ago due to the storms. We lost part of it, and it was falling apart, and the anchor broke loose from its anchors. At this time, the port is now requesting assistance from the state and consideration from this committee to accomplish the stabilization of the ship hull Paisley as quickly as possible to prevent the following potential environmental effects and public liability. A work scope can be provided for additional information. It is estimated to do the stabilization is cost as high as $4 million. Release of 2,000 gallons of oil that's in the piping system now is what we're trying to avoid, or any residual oil left in the tank. Also, the release of approximately 136 gallons of contaminated water. Response costs to address release of bunker and other contaminated water into Yaquina Bay. Salvage costs to remove portions of the ship that may fall into the bay is important. And costs associated with the natural resource damages. We want to avoid fines associated with releases of contaminants to the waters of the United States and Oregon, and third-party lawsuits would be inevitable from other groups that are affected by the releases of contaminants into the bay. So these are the things that we're trying to avoid. In addition to the above potential environmental effects and liabilities, the following critical habitat issues are also concerns of the port and the community. And I'll go through those.
Don?
Yes, ma'am.
What I would like to ask at this point is if we could just pause for a moment. Maybe one of you could allow Paul Evans to come forward. We'll get back to some of the technical fixes that are required. Paul, why don't you go ahead and come up and trade places with one of these fine folks for just a moment. Don't go far. Because the request before us today is for some help with an emergency declaration, and before Paul has to leave, it would be helpful then if you could explain to the committee, please, what the process is that would be needed to get this and what the potential assistance is. And then we can get back to some of the technical pieces of it.
Yes, ma'am. Chair Cowan, members of the committee, thank you for indulging my schedule. We're getting ready to send 109 soldiers to Iraq today, so I'm kind of going back and forth. What I understand right now, I was actually contacted by the ERT team as well as the chair, and have had a conversation with the port. And this is a situation that kind of is a, it's not yet a disaster, but a disaster that can be seen. I mean, it's going to be. And current statute is, especially at the state and the federal level, is a little bit vague in terms of providing specific authorities to act. It's almost like a pre-crime type thing where we know it's there and it's hard to put our arms around. It is beyond the traditional definitions of an emergency. However, there is precedent. The governor has declared a salmon disaster last year that was representing of the fact that the impact is a disaster, even if the cause does not meet the traditional 24-hour or 48-hour weather-caused or human-caused reasoning. So the recommendations here really today are that a couple of twin tracks. The first is that if the port could also get the county commission to declare a disaster in that case. And at the same time, if this committee could in a letter or a statement, explain how this really is an impact and that in this particular case it meets a similar standard to the salmon disaster, the governor's office could work to try to utilize whatever tools we can utilize in this type of case, knowing that it may not ever get to be a presidential disaster, but it may well free up some of the rules, regs, and allow us to tap into some funds. Unfortunately, if we did have the Oregon declared emergency relief fund adequately funded, we could use that. Under current circumstances, though, we've been having negotiations and discussions with the state fire marshal's office and other entities, and there may be some pots of money on the emergency side of the house. Ken is actually working on trying to work with DEQ and state lands and others to see if there's available funds together. The bottom line is, if this committee a letter from this committee would certainly help make the case that the salmon disaster is an acceptable model. We did that. The governor did that before, but we haven't really had a legislative discussion about that approach since. So it's one of those things where we think we can do it. If we have legislative support of it, it's a whole lot more easy to get the people around the table and try to find the pots of money to use for this particular event. And final point is, I think that one of the points that really can be emphasized is that it isn't just that there's a disaster that's going to be impacting the environment and the people and the economy, but also in this particular case, the community's done the responsible thing. They passed a bond. They are working on a plan, and I think that that's a major piece of your argument. So I'm going to stop rambling there and see if there's a question or two.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Perhaps you could elaborate just a little bit on some of the other potential after a disaster declaration. Of course, if we can find some source of emergency funding, that's
right.
Swell. But there would also be some potential assistance in terms of from the National Guard. Mm-hmm. And perhaps maybe if you could also touch on even streamlining some of the permitting process to begin some of the work that's already contemplated in the measure.
Chair Cowan, absolutely. Once a declaration of disaster has been made, it allows all state agencies the ability to kind of share in the attack the problem, basically. Now, again, reimbursement and costs are always one of those things that go along with it, but it does allow, because of the exigencies involved, it allows a focus of thought and opens up the checkbooks a little bit to be able to do some things we can't otherwise do. It also provides at least the legal grounds for a discussion about either wavering or speeding up processes that are currently in place, as well as I believe if it is a disaster, then it allows us to tap into a couple of funds that we couldn't otherwise tap into that have to do with petroleum offload and some other things related to hazardous material spills that I think we can utilize in this case. So the goal right now really is kind of have one unified voice, bring the agencies together, find a way to fix what we can in the short term. Again, there's not a lot of money to find. I think there's some, but the chair is right that it allows us to use National Guard, ODOT, and other agencies potentially corrections for manpower and other things if we need to do that as well.
Thank you. Are there any specific questions of Paul before I excuse him to do his other duties today?
Thank you for
accommodating us and giving us your input.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Please offer the committee's best to the individuals who are being deployed. We're sorry that this conflict of time didn't allow us to be there today.
I will, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And please come back. I apologize for that interruption, but I really felt that his information would be important to the conversation. Now, go ahead, and I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and we really appreciate the opportunity to hear Paul's explanation as well. And I am almost done, and what I would like to talk about is a little bit about the additional potential environmental effects of the Paisley failing, and to point out that the Yaquina Bay is designated a critical habitat for Oregon coastal coho salmon and proposed critical habitat of green sturgeon listed under the Federal Endangered Species Act. And the bay is also classified as essential fish habitat for many commercially important marine and anadromous species managed under the Magnuson-Stephen Fisheries Conservation and Management Act. The potential failure of the Paisley could result in prohibited take of ESA-listed species via releases of harmful materials, petroleum, hydrocarbons, or fine sediments, and habitat disturbance from falling debris from the into the water and any cleanup activities that would occur afterwards. Uncontrolled failure of the Paisley would not allow for the full implementation of standard best management practices as planned as our environmental protection measures as we planned with the construction of the project. The only other thing I would like to add is that I attended the county commission meeting yesterday in Lincoln County, and the board unanimously approved a motion to declare an emergency for the Ports International project based on the condition of the Paisley and the Hennebeek, and directed their staff to prepare a declaration for the adoption of the commission in the proper form after consultation with port and other officials. So we've taken that step to discuss this with our county commissioners, and they realized the problem, and I made a presentation yesterday to that effect. Having said that, Madam Chairman, that concludes my remarks, and I would try to answer any questions.
Thank you. Maybe to set the stage for this just a little bit, and my terminology is not going to be technical, so thankfully you have the professionals here that know what they're talking about. As I understand it from conversations with the port director, there are sort of two options out there. I think it's pretty much generally accepted that there's an impending disaster here. We don't know when it might occur. We don't know what kind of a storm we might have. And the project that's designed within the bond that's been passed locally, and yes, I will acknowledge that I do live in Lincoln County and near this bay, which is why I'm familiar with the project. The project plans call for putting in some sheet pile bulkhead, and if that direction were to be, we were to be able to do that quickly enough, the $4.5 to $5 million that part of the project is estimated to cost would be part of the overall big picture project
construction,
and bond proceeds could be used in order to do that. There'd have to be some waiver of the timeline on some of the permitting process, and that might or might not be an opportunity under an emergency declaration. If that's not possible, then this hull needs a giant Band-Aid, and that, however it is that they do that, costs about $1.5 million, so we'd be trying to find money to do that that would not be appropriate to the project that's planned under the bond. And is that a fair summation of...
That's very fair, and I would let Craig maybe address that a little bit further if you'd like. And I know that the Band-Aid approach, only a portion of that type of construction could be used toward the final construction of the project, but not all of it. And it would be, what we're trying to avoid is spending money that has on something that has to be torn back out in order to do the construction.
Also, the Band-Aid...
Could you identify yourself for the record?
I'm Ginny Goblish from Newport, Oregon, chairman of the Port of Newport Commission. The Band-Aid, as it was explained by KPFF at our Tuesday night commission meeting, was no guarantee that it still wouldn't fail. In other words, the Band-Aid might hold the stern, the area that's cracked, that's ready to go in place, but then the rest of the ship would be impacted and could go. There are no guarantees there.
Understood.
And there's a couple of things in Don's presentation that I thought was really important to underline, and one was, you said that the ship had moved 8 inches over 60 years. We have Denison Surveying monitoring the ship movement on an ongoing basis, and it's moved an inch in the past 36 days. So the movement has greatly accelerated. And also, Mike Ness, our engineer, said that... basically, we're living on borrowed time. So that comes directly from our engineers, of which you're part of that. So it doesn't sound like much movement over 60 years, but when you're looking at the time frame now, this thing is moving very quickly.
Understood.
I don't think I have much to add to that.
Oh, thank you.
Very well said.
Questions from the committee? Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Now, you say you bonded for this for the future, or
Representative Collins, Representative Esquivel. The in 2006, we passed a bond measure to completely rebuild the terminal facility to eliminate continuing to use the old ships as the platform for the terminal. And the estimated cost to do the project was approximately $18 million. And we have the funding to do the project. And as Commissioner Govers has mentioned, the movement has escalated to the point where the Paisley has presented a problem. If we were a year out now from when we started the process for permitting, it's going slower than we anticipated. So we can't get in the water to begin the project to subsequently stop this movement with the construction. So now we need to have a supplemental fix in the meantime, or an immediate fix, unless we can get in there and do the project completely. So the bond measure was passed to completely rebuild the facility.
So you've discovered, yes, Madam Chair, so you've discovered the enemy, and it's us, with bureaucratic red tape.
We got it.
Correct.
Astounds me, sir.
Also, we're limited to in-water work sessions, so which is November to February. So we're not looking at being able to do anything at all with that ship until next winter at the earliest. And we were hoping to be able to get it stabilized this winter, but because of the process we're undergoing, it's taking a long time. National Marine Fisheries Service is short-staffed, and they need a minimum of 6 months to do anything with the permitting.
Madam Chairman, Representative Esquivel, and we're not asking to circumvent the process.
Right.
And we've done everything we can, and we continue to have meetings with the agencies to answer their questions, provide as much information as we need to keep that permit process moving. And we want to continue to do that, but in the meantime, with the escalation of the condition of the Paisley, we're trying to get something done as soon as we can.
Over here first, he was
all right,
first.
Let's start on the end then.
Actually, thank you, Madam Chair. It's actually a couple questions, but are you guys planning on pulling the ships out and doing something different in your rebuild plan?
Representative Cowan, Representative Widener, one of the options early on discussed was that do we have to remove them to the ships in order to continue on with our project? And as we continue to do the design and engineering and look at the environmental controls that we had to put in place, the ships did not have to be removed in order to accomplish our project. by putting them behind the proposed new sheet pile bulkhead and encapsulating them. First, we would stabilize them with the sheet pile bulkhead, then go in and remediate any contaminants that are in the vessels, and then put the fill in over top of them, and they would not, they'd be mostly just fill is what they'd end up being, and they'd be encapsulated behind the new sheet pile bulkheads. So we didn't have to remove them in order to get to the point where we reach our environmental controls. So and the cost for removing them is way beyond the cost of our repairs. We did just finish the estimates on complete removal and rebuilding the facility, and it was over $32 million.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You talked about being able to get in the water only from November through February. Is that correct?
Correct.
If you get this disaster declaration, does that still hold true? When could you get in and actually do the work needed to stabilize?
Representative Cowan, Representative Riley, the answer to that is probably unknown at this point. There have been times when there have been extensions on the in-water work windows to do certain work within the bays and estuaries along the coast. So there's an opportunity if there's an emergency recognized that we may be able to go beyond that window, and that's up strictly up to the agencies to allow us to do that.
Follow up.
And is that state agencies or federal agencies?
Representative Cowan, Representative Riley, it's both. And so we have to deal with both the state side and the federal side.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Okay, if there are no further specific questions, I appreciate your presentation today. Thank you very much. And we're kind of in a little bit of unknown territory here, but I think the question before us is if it's the will of the committee to draft a letter supporting the County Commissioner's request for an emergency declaration.
Madam Chair, I move that we authorize the Chair to prepare that letter for the committee.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Is there an objection? Seeing none, we will undertake to get this letter drafted and see if we can proceed.
Thank you, Representative Cowan, and I don't want to leave without saying hello to a friend to the north, Representative Boone.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Esteville.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just, it's very disturbing to me that we have created such a monster that when we have a pending disaster where you have an ecological malfunction that may happen here in the immediate future, that we can't seem to get past the red tape. That just astounds me that we would be so bent on, quote, rules that we can't react to a situation that needs tending to.
Thank you. So noted. We will move now to our second informational piece of today's meeting, which is an update on the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network, Lindsay Ball. And I am going to officially, as of this moment, declare Owen a word, so you may refer to it in its shortened form if you wish.
Thank you, Chair Cowan. If I may ask, I know there was some discussion earlier about using the laptop on projection. Mr. Molina, where are we at with that?
We're good.
I'm sorry. I'll turn it on right now.
No.
Okay.
Sure.
Do
we
have it on that?
Sure. I want to
bring that back.
How are you? Hey, put this forward. Chair Cowan, members of the committee, my name is Lindsay Ball. I work in Governor Kulongoski's office, and I'm assigned to the Owen Project. And for the record, Owen stands for the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network. We'll go to page 3 and give you a history at a glance. This actually the project actually was conceived in 2002 by executive order signed by Governor Kitzhaber at the time, and there was also a statewide interoperable executive council that was established as well. In 2005, House Bill 2101 passed, establishing interoperability and system consolidation, which brought four state agencies, Department of Transportation, Correction, State Police, and Forestry, who currently have four distinct and separate statewide radio systems, bring them into one consolidated radio communication system. In 2007, the legislature did have an opportunity to review the proposed build-out of the Owen project. We were instructed at that time to reduce the costs. And then in 2008, during the February 2008 session, we again received direction from the legislature to reduce costs by forming partnerships, which I think in the presentation you'll see becomes the cornerstone of this effort. We also were directed to move forward with Phase 1 planning. We received grants from the community-oriented policing grants, the integrated wireless network through U.S. Department of Justice, and we also conducted a study, one of a kind, that has never been done in anywhere in the world. Oregon conducted a study proving that the communication industry was giving us advice that was not particularly accurate, and we could reduce the infrastructure build-out by 30%. We also established the Columbia River Intertribal Fisheries Commission link on the Columbia River Gorge from Portland to Pendleton. And we have received, as of this week, I just got the word the other day that it was final. We did receive the full $76 million for Phase 1 build-out of Owen. That will go up from the bond sale February 10th of this year. Again, early goals was to consolidate four aging state-owned systems, include access for local public safety agencies to maximize our interoperability. That is, we can finally get to a point where everyone in the public safety community can talk to one another, and also maximize the partnerships and collaboration at all levels of government. And as I go through the presentation, I want you to reflect on the partnerships. We have not been turned down by any party, not one, to partner up with us. It's been quite heartening around the state when we've gone and talked to people about co-locating and partnering with this project. We have found local governments, federal governments, as well as tribal government to be very receptive to us. There is a federal mandate that requires all agencies and private enterprise with wideband radio communication systems to go to a narrowband by December 31st, 2012. The state of Oregon functions on wideband analog radio system. We are not digital in the state. I know that many of you have cell phones. You understand what digital is from your cell phone. You can send pictures. We can't. So think of that in respect of a missing child or a suspect that we're trying to locate in the public safety arena. In addition to that, by going to the digital system, we will be able to transmit data, driver's license checks and things of that nature, over the communication system. This migration from wideband to narrowband is mandatory. If we don't comply by December 31st of 2012, we have the potential of losing our current radio frequencies and also any federal money that might come across. Now, I've also heard comments that maybe we can just push that date out. I don't think that's realistic to think that way, and let me explain why. Our society has an insatiable hunger for bandwidth. We are using more bandwidth than ever before. We have more cell phones, more streaming video, all of that that's taken care of by wireless. And the reason that the federal government is shrinking from wideband to narrowband is to free up bandwidth to be used in the commercial sector. And the Federal Communications Commission is selling those frequencies off to the industry. And once they get those frequencies and have purchased them, they're going to want to use them. And if we create interference with them, that is where the rub comes. They purchase the frequency, they want to use it, bottom line. So when the deadline comes, their switch is turned on, and they'll expect to use their frequency bandwidth. System requirements. System-wide, statewide interoperability, trunked digital technologies. It'll be P25 standard, which is a federally recognized standard for public safety communication. It is a land mobile radio system, so in effect what that means is you can move about the state and communicate throughout the state of Oregon on the system. It will provide data coverage, as I mentioned, across all Oregon sites as well. The system that we are using has been proven as being reliable in emergencies such as the December 2007 storms on the Oregon coast. Not to pick on Clatsop County, because I think they are in my estimation the most beleaguered with respect to communication. But in the December 2007 storm, they lost communication. They have a repeater system. They were not on microwave, and they were dependent upon fiber. The system that we're putting in has a backbone on fiber and is built with a P25 digital trunk radio system and should be able to stand up against the weather and the storm that we had December of 2007. And in fact, the current state system was the only communication system left standing after that storm, and it is in disrepair itself and obsolete. And I'll talk about the obsolescence of our system at this point with this slide. We're built on 1940 and 1950s technology. As I mentioned, we're analog, we're not digital. In the evaluation done by a consulting firm, 80% of the sites in Oregon need to be rebuilt. Shelters, radio shelters, the buildings associated with towers need to be replaced. The towers themselves need to be replaced. We have some structures that are made of wood instead of steel, which is way below standard for the industry. I have staff in the four state agencies that surf eBay weekly looking for spare parts to keep our system running today. They do not manufacture parts for our radio system any longer. We find used parts on eBay and buy them when we can and then stockpile them for future use and replacement. Now, you can ask why we've gotten to that point, and it's an issue of choice and priorities. Do you lay off troopers from the road, or do you ignore the radio system? And we've chosen to ignore the radio system and keep as many police officers on the road. We've also elected to maintain bridges and highways and not repair the radio system. So we've just gotten ourselves to a point where now we need to replace 80% of our infrastructure associated with the communication system. I'm not saying we did anything bad. That's just we had to make some hard choices, and they were made. But we're now to the point where we need to fix the system as a whole. We also have limited microwave backbone capacity, limits ability for voice communication, and there is no data. And you also need to think about the state, 95,000 square miles, and look at our geography. It's what makes Oregon very unique with the system of watersheds, deep canyons, wide valleys, high mountains. Those all pose problems for radio communication because it is line of sight. It doesn't bend well around mountains and valleys. This gives a picture of some of the sites that we have in Oregon. The upper left and the lower right are industry standards. Everything else in between is what you see in use in Oregon today. And I think the pictures speak for themselves as to where we've gotten ourselves. Now, I will explain a little bit. The picture on the upper right is a tower that was over at Ontario. It picked up some ice load. The wind came up and snapped the tower off. The lower left is a wooden tower that is in your district, Representative Boone, that's on Neoconi Mountain. We are working with the local broadcasters in that area, as well as the county, and two other private providers on refurbishing that site and putting in an industry standard radio site. If everything goes according to plan, I think we'll use Neoconi as the model to show how you can have private, local government, and state government all collaborating at the same site and saving each other a lot of money. Let's go back to the 2007 legislature when they first learned of the $665 million price tag assigned to Owen. It was deemed to be excessive. Sticker shock, I think, grabbed everyone. No cost savings from partnership and construction project had limited state participation. In other words, it was basically a turnkey. We would go get a contractor, tell the contractor, fix this in 5 years, report back, and give the radio system to us. I have a real aversion to that. I'm quite adamant the state needs to be totally engaged in any kind of a contract of this magnitude, particularly when you're working with partners. And the other thing that I brought forth when we revisited how we look at this concept, I was pretty insistent that the state shouldn't function on its own, that we should look for partners. And that includes the private sector as well. And as I mentioned, I've been very pleased with the base of support we've gotten from local government. It's quite heartening. The 2008 legislature did direct us to partner with the Northwest 7 and the Southwest 7 and Central Counties. Now, I will point out there was one county that was left out when we looked at the Northwest 7 and the Southwest 7. That was Lincoln County. Hmm. And we were doing a lot of work real fast. And I will never forget when Sheriff Dennis Dotson called me and he said, Lindsay, you're talking to everybody but us. We're caught in the middle and we don't have anywhere to go. And so I said, we're going to get to you as soon as we can. And in a couple of weeks, we're able to get over and sit down with Lincoln County and talk about how we can move the microwave backbone through Lincoln on down the coast. We've done some real good work in Lincoln County with some partnerships. The plan is to place a site on Euchre Mountain and also on Cape Perpetua that will help the local communication system as well as create the leg of microwave we need for the coastal communities. This 2008 session also set aside the $76 million so we can continue our planning and the concept of this phase one, which is the western half of Oregon. If you take a line from the Dalles to Bend to Klamath and go to the coast, that's phase one. The current established partnerships, One National, which is the integrated wireless network, U.S. Department of Justice, that goes from Portland to Medford at this time. It was a grant that came to us as a result of the Summer Olympic tryouts in Eugene this last summer. They needed that communication link to provide security associated with that event. One Regional, which is the Columbia River Intertribal Fisheries Commission up the Columbia Gorge, and also the Community-Oriented Policing Services Grant. 35 local partners. Now, we've picked up a couple more just in the last day. That is TriMet up in the Portland area, as well as PacifiCorps. And PacifiCorps, maybe a lot of people don't understand how utilities work, but they have to have an extensive radio system in order to operate their power facilities throughout the country. And they build their systems to a very rigorous standard, very typical of a safe public safety standard for reliability. And we have found several sites that we can share with them and they can share with us. And I think that will help us reduce costs as well. There's a list of the local partners, the 35 that I mentioned earlier. We also are looking beyond the state of Oregon. The federal government has a mandate in order to create a nationwide communications network. I reached out to our neighboring states, including Utah, and asked if they would be interested in partnering with Oregon to demonstrate that we could facilitate a nationwide network. As we build our system out, it would be better to include the federal government in our system rather than trying to shoehorn them in at a later date at more cost to us. The five states all agreed it was very wise to do that. We reached out to the federal government. They were quite shocked. They haven't seen anyone in the United States form a coalition to invite them in to our system. That's another Oregon first, you might say. Currently, with the change of the administration, everything's been placed on hold, but the concept has not evaporated. In addition to that, I also have a concern that if we don't create a link between our states, we can't serve our people as well, because a communication link with emergency management centers of our neighboring states will prove very helpful to us in the future if we have a serious disaster in the state. There's been a lot of talk about potential tsunamis in the coastal region as well as the Columbia River, earthquakes in the city of Portland, etc. Those kinds of events are catastrophic, and I'm sure we'd be relying on our neighbors to help us out before the federal government would be able to respond. We also conducted a drive test. I mentioned earlier we turned the communication industry on their ear for a while and still are. They were telling us that by going to a 700 megahertz, now I'm not trying to confuse you with too much technology here, but 700 megahertz is what the Federal Communications Commission set aside for public safety. We've functioned on VHF for many, many years, still do to this day. But the Federal Communications Commission said 700 is where public safety is going to have a set-aside for frequencies. But they also told us that if we go to 700, we would have to increase our build-out of infrastructure by 30% over what we currently have in VHF, which increases the price tag. We asked the simple question, or I guess I did, show me the test or the research that's been done comparing 700 to VHF. Come to find out, no one in the industry or anywhere else had done it. We conducted a test. We spent about $300,000 on that test, and we were able to prove that 700 is 3 to 5% less, covers 3 to 5% less than what VHF does off the antenna. We also learned that we could tweak the antenna to the 700, and we could probably erase that 3 to 5%. So VHF and 700 will function the same in the digital world, and we can reduce the cost for that was initially quoted to us. Our plan objectives is to build out an interoperable statewide system. The network will be used by state agencies, and it's available to local and tribal and federal governments. We're not mandating that anyone use the system, but it is available to them, and we are encouraging co-location of our equipment at radio sites throughout the state. And again, we are to have the network operational by December 31st, 2012, in order to meet the federal deadline. There are four phases to this project. We're currently in phase one. We hope to have that concluded by December 2010. Phase two will start this July, and that's the radio installation in western Oregon and infrastructure build-out in the northern half of eastern Oregon. Phase three is radio installation in the northern half of eastern Oregon, infrastructure build-out in the south half of eastern Oregon. And finally, phase four is when we install the last of the radios in the southern half of eastern Oregon. That gives you a pictorial of where on the map as to where the phase one system is. That's our contact information. And Chair Cowan, I'll be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the timely presentation. Representative Boone.
Thank you. And thank you, Lindsay, for doing the west side of the state first. I know we asked that, and you had to shift gears and do that. But it was important because of the imminent dangers of tsunami, earthquake on the west side could cause catastrophic disasters. And we've seen other catastrophic disasters in our storm events, and would have been very handy to have had it in place the last few years. So thank you for all you've been doing to move this forward.
Well, thank you. I have to make sure I remind everyone this is a project that where we've been working very closely with legislators. There's a legislative work group assigned to this project as well that we are meeting with on every 2 weeks, if not more often. Representative Riley is a member of that work group, as is Senator Johnson, Senator Verger, and Senator Nelson, Representative Nathanson, and Representative Jensen.
All good.
Senator Riley, did you have another question or comment?
Oh, I have no questions.
Maybe I was, well, I know that you're well-versed in this, but I must have been imagining something.
You must have been.
That is possible. I have a question. Because of the differences in the geography and the terrain, when we build out to the east side of the state, and since Senator Nelson is on the work group, I'm sure that is being pushed as rapidly as possible. Will it be any less challenging, less expensive, whatever, since there's more line of sight and less of the terrain you have to deal with at the coast?
Chair Cowan, because of the geography and topography associated with the Coast Range of Oregon, that's the most challenging with respect to engineering a communication system, because it is line of sight, and if anyone's lived on the coast or travels to the coast, there's lots of mountains, lots of drainages where highways are that require to have where communication is required, and so consequently you have to build more radio sites to keep that line of sight configuration in place, because if that's broken by a mountain, there is no communication. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, western half of Oregon is the most challenging, will require the most sites. In eastern Oregon, you will have some of that, but not as nearly as extensive as you have in western Oregon.
Great. Well, seeing no others, one final question. You and I had talked a little bit in our hearing about the storm event. We sort of began to uncover some of the challenges with redundancy in phone lines that sometimes compromise our kind of distant areas for 911 communication, understanding that this doesn't get into the world of that kind of communication. Could you elaborate a little bit more on the radio contact availability that may help our emergency responders during times that we have challenges with our emergency communications?
Yeah, Chair Cowan, the concept behind this system with the microwave backbone divorces us from a fiber network. A lot of the trouble that has been associated with public safety communication of late is because of the failure of the fiber backbone rather than a microwave backbone. Lots of reasons for that. In the December 2007 storm on the coast, we saw high water take out a fiber line on a bridge. We saw high water take out the fiber line that was laid along a railroad track. In fact, it took three lines out at that time on the Salmonberry. We also saw a landslide take out fiber. In addition to that, we've also seen fiber become the victim of theft, people thinking it's copper wire instead of glass fiber inside. And so people will come up and take out 1,000 feet of fiber line, but that causes the communication system for public safety to crash. We've also seen people go to a fiber line with a blowtorch or a propane torch, melt the insulation to see if they have copper or glass, but they destroy the glass, and again, you lose your radio communication. In addition to that, the other complicating factor for fiber is Backhoe Bob. The fellow that comes along starts digging a trench, and lo and behold, cuts right through the fiber line, but then you're dead in the water without any communication. Now, put that in perspective. If you're going to have a communication system for public safety, and it's a law enforcement issue or a life-threatening issue with ambulance response, etc., and all at once someone cuts the line and you have none, there could be some dire consequences as a result of that. The system that we are putting in is called the 5-9 system. It's 99.999% operational. That means in a year's time, it's only down for 5 minutes and no more. So that's as high as reliable of a system that you can put in, and that's what our concept is. And I feel that it, I feel very secure that we'll provide the best for the people of Oregon. It's also going to be a digital trunk system which will allow multiple talk groups. And I think that's important to note because as we build this interoperable system into it, we're going to be allow any city, county, you know, state agency, fire service with the interoperable channel. They can switch to interoperable and they can get into the state owned system. And from that, the dispatcher can route their radio communication anywhere in the state, which I think is going to be extremely important for law enforcement and fire services.
Well, thank you very much. If there are no further questions, I think it's just important that we keep updated on how things are going along. I appreciate your time today.
And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to call. I'm available at a minute's notice.
Thank you very much.
Do I have his cell phone number?
Oh, I'm sure you do. With that, I'm going to close our informational portion of today's hearing. And in our transition, Representative Huffman, would you have an interest in joining us up here, or are you going to be part of introducing the next group?
I'll do the introductions, and then I can join you.
Okay. You'll be welcome at any point in time. It's like we have some other guests. Welcome. And okay. Thank you. As we transition to a public hearing, I want to pause for just a moment if the committee would indulge us. I think it's important for the Veterans Services Committee to recognize that we have had some casualties today. The Department of Defense announced today the death of four soldiers who were supporting Operation Iraqi Freedom. They died from wounds suffered when two OH-58D Kiowa Warrior helicopters crashed on the 26th of January in Kirkuk. They were assigned to the 6th Squadron, 6th Cavalry Regiment, 10th Combat Aviation Brigade, 10th Mountain Division, Fort Drum, New York. Among those killed were Chief Warrant Officer Joshua M. Tillery, age 31, from Beaverton, Oregon. Chief Tillery was a graduate of Banks High School and has family in Beaverton and Irigan. The ceremony for Chief Tillery is scheduled for the 6th at Willamette National. And Vice Chair Matthews, we'd like to recognize this individual.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I think, you know, these times are always difficult for all of us, and this is much for everybody in the room, for this committee, with the work that we've been charged with, of course, this session, which is extremely important in the interest of Veterans Affairs, and we all know that. This news also falls on the heels, obviously, of where we're wishing well to 109 of our soldiers that are getting ready to be deployed for another mission to Iraq, and that's where Paul Evans was off to earlier today. So if you would please indulge me, Madam Chair and committee and guests in the audience, too, with just a brief moment of silence in honor of the ultimate sacrifice paid by Chief Tillery and the support that he's received from his family. It is a tremendous loss not only to his unit, but to his community, to his family, to our state, and to this great nation. Thank you, Madam
Thank
Chair.
You very much. With that, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2079. Mr. Molina, could you brief us on this piece of legislation?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2079 would require all boat operators and passengers to wear a life jacket or personal flotation device on any section of waters rated Class 3 or higher on a commonly accepted scale of river difficulty.
Thank you very much. Representative Huffman is with us today and would like to introduce his constituents who will be doing a presentation on this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate the opportunity. Members of the committee, I'm John Huffman, for the record, representative for District 59. We enjoy a lot of outdoor recreational activities in District 59, but our focus today will be directed at whitewater rafting and, as you'll hear in testimony, specifically Class 3 rapids and above. Normally, I'm not the kind of person that likes to engage in seatbelt laws and helmet laws and, you know, in mandating and forcing our constituents to act or use certain devices or act in a certain way. But as you'll hear in this compelling testimony from some of my constituents, I think it's time to do something. And I just appreciate the opportunity to bring HB 2079 before you. Thank you so much. And we've got Wasco County Commissioner Sherry Holliday and Wasco County Marine Deputy Roger Pierce and a couple of others that are going to testify. And you can bring them up at your will, Madam Chair. But I know that Roger probably will want to come up first with the PowerPoint. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And you're welcome to join us up here where you can see it if you like. Sheriff Pierce, would you like to begin your PowerPoint? And you can bring your team up as you wish.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me just take a moment to get this PowerPoint up.
And to help you out a little bit with your timing, we'll have about 45 minutes for a presentation of the issue and any testimony on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
While we're
setting up,
First of all, I need you to introduce yourself for the record and make sure that you can be heard in the microphone, if you would, please. In other words, you probably have to sit down.
May we try it if I speak out? I'm going to need to be doing some work with the presentation, if that's okay.
As long as our good assistant feels that we're recording okay. Okay? Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, first of all, thank you for your time in allowing me to talk about life jackets today. I am Deputy Roger Pierce. I work for the Wasco County Sheriff's Office. I am the Marine Deputy there. Very briefly, a little bit about myself. I started with Wasco County in 1988, was assigned as a resident deputy in South Wasco County near Maupin, which is alongside the Deschutes River. In 1990, I was appointed as the Search and Rescue Coordinator, responsible for all rescues and recoveries throughout the county, including those on the Deschutes River. Then about 6 or 7 years ago, I became the Marine Deputy for Wasco County. I'm one of the instructors for the Oregon State Marine Board. I teach basic boating skills at the Marine Board Law Enforcement Academy. I also teach drift boat and jet boat operations on the Rogue River, again for the Oregon State Marine Board. My objective today here is simply to obtain your support to change an existing law that we have to make the wearing of an approved whitewater PFD or life jacket mandatory for everyone in a boat in a Class 3 or above rapid. This change is specific to Class 3 and greater rapids and whitewater life jackets. And we've purposely left the life jacket up to the Marine Board, the specific jacket, because of changes in technology and Coast Guard regulations. When we do that, then those changes can be accommodated by the Marine Board in OAR without the need to return to the legislature to make updated changes. Also, whitewater rapids classification, we're going to be talking about that a little bit, is universal to all rivers in Oregon and everywhere else. We need to talk about PFDs or life jackets a little bit and types, because we're referring to whitewater jackets and there is an important difference. Type 1 jackets are those that are normally used offshore. Type 2 are the normal, you've seen them, horse collar style. They're a nearshore jacket. Type 3 is our most common jacket. This is a Type 3 jacket right here. It's a common ski jacket. Type 4s are throwables. You've seen them, the cushions in boats or the rings. Those are designed to be thrown to a victim. And Type 5s. Type 5 simply means special purpose. And one of those special purpose jackets is a whitewater jacket, such as this jacket right here. The difference between these two jackets, again, this is Type 3 ski jacket. This is a Type 5 whitewater jacket, is about 10 pounds flotation. Okay? That 10 pounds, well, that corresponds to the average human head, so that could be an important 10-pound difference, okay? Current law requires those in guided boats only, to wear a jacket like this whenever they are in Class 3 and above rapids. That's our current law. Okay? It's called white water because it's white. This water around here is filled with air, okay, and doesn't support you very well. People don't float in this water nearly as well as in undisturbed water. I'd like to draw your attention to the two young men in the front of this boat. Neither one is wearing a life jacket, and you can see their jackets in the bottom of the boat right here. Seconds after this picture was taken, this boat hit a rock and capsized. And tragically, this young man right here lost his life. Same boat. This is the rock right over here that it hit. I'll draw your attention first to this person right here next to the boat. You'll notice how they are floating head and shoulders out of the water because of the jacket they're wearing. Compare that to this young man right here, his head barely above water. He's fighting to stay afloat, a battle he lost. His life jacket is floating right behind him, but even if he got it, putting it on in these conditions is nearly impossible. Okay? Go ahead. Quickly, as we go through the rapids classification, because this legislation pertains to Class 3 and above only, it's important that we understand what we're talking about. Class 1, it's really just moving water. Okay? Flat, broad sections of river. It's moving, but there are no obstacles, and anyone can float down. It's not a problem. Class 2, not much more. There may be a rock or two here and there. There may be some waves, but even those that are fairly inexperienced can actually maneuver through that water without any real problem. Class 3, this is where it begins. This is intermediate, and this is important. Rapids are moderate with irregular waves, which are difficult to avoid. Complex maneuvering is required to avoid capsizing. Large waves and or strainers, which are logs or trees across the river that can entrap a boat and drown people as they're driven underneath them. Strong currents can make self-rescue difficult. Scouting is advised for inexperienced paddlers. And this is where true white water begins in Class 3. This is where, under current law, if you're in a guided boat, you're required to wear a proper white water life jacket. Class 4, this is just a Class 3 on steroids. The water's bigger, it's faster, the waves are bigger. Takes a little more expertise. You've got to be on your game to get through this without a problem. Injuries can and do occur in Class 4 rapids. You don't want to be out of the boat. Class 5, this is expert water. Okay, this is stuff that is usually run in kayaks and is left up to the experts. The risk of injury or death is fairly high. In Class 6, this is just plain silly. Okay, if you make a mistake, or even if you don't, in a Class 6, you very well may die. In Oregon, we have at least 16 rivers and creeks that are serious whitewater. These rivers here all have Class 3 and above rapids in them, okay, and there's also numerous creeks and forks that feed these that have Class 3 and above rapids. With several of these rivers, there are also businesses nearby that depend on the heavy rafting traffic that these rivers get. This is the lower Deschutes River, the lower 100 miles. Okay? At the average river speed of about 4 to 5 miles per hour, it takes 20 to 25 hours to float the entire lower 100 miles of the Deschutes River, usually done in 3 or 4 days. Now, boats are usually in a particular rapid less than a minute. It's pretty fast water, and you shoot right through it. We've got a couple that are a little bit longer. White Horse Rapid is sort of a combination of several rapids. It takes a little longer. But the average is less than a minute. So we have 11 rapids here, not including Shears Falls. That's one of those, it's crazy, you don't want to do that rapids, okay? We have 11 rapids. So we're asking boaters to wear their life jackets out of 20 to 25 hours, 11 minutes, or about 1% of their time on the water. We think that's reasonable. I'd like to show you, for those of you that may not be rafters, how these accidents happen, because they happen a lot. How boats flip. One is broadside on a rock, and the other is in a recirculating or keeper hole. Those are the two most common. This is Wapanisha Rapid on the Deschutes River. First of all, I'd like you to look at these folks and look. They're all looking very concentrated at something just downstream from them. Go ahead. That's what they were looking at, this rock right here. It's the same rock that flipped the boat in the earlier slide where the young man drowned. When this section here, the downstream side of this boat, hits this rock, it's driven upwards by the force of the water that drives the upstream side down. And as soon as it hits the water, it's all over. The boat immediately capsizes. Go ahead. This is the same boat coming around the rock upside down. Draw your attention to this gentleman right here. Notice how he's floating, head and shoulders above the water, wearing his life jacket. People popping out from under the boat. Go ahead. Most everyone is out here now. Everyone was wearing the life jacket. Everyone survived this particular accident. It had a happy ending, although that rapid has claimed several lives. And again, notice here, even those not holding on to the boat, all floating head and shoulders out of the water because of their life jackets. This is Oak Springs Rapid, below Maupin, serious whitewater, and this is a keeper or recirculating hole. There is a difference in elevation of about 6 or 7 feet between the water surface here and the water surface here. So there's quite a ledge right here that the water is driving down. As it does so, it comes down with such force that it goes underneath this water here, comes back up in a recirculating motion. So this water that's right here on top is actually flowing upstream in this direction, and the two meet right on that line that you see right here. Go ahead. Okay, this boat's already in trouble because no one's paddling. Okay? The way to get through a keeper hole is to paddle forward hard because this water, remember, is moving this way, not this way. Go ahead. Okay, we're going to see what happens to this boat. I'll just take you quickly through the pictures because there's a few of them, but we're going to see what happens to a boat in a recirculating hole. Go ahead. Okay, they're just now poking through. Go ahead. Now they're up on the other side of the line. Go ahead. Draw your attention to this little white splash right back here. Okay? Instead of moving forward, this boat was driven back into the wall, and they're now contacting that wall. Okay? Because no one's paddling. Okay? Go ahead. Here we go. Being driven further back into the wall of water, you notice this side of the boat is tipping up. Okay? Go ahead. They're getting buffeted around quite a bit by this water coming down. I mean, keep your eye right over here in this corner of the boat. Okay? There goes our first one. Okay, he's going out, and look where he's going out at. Exactly where these two forces of water are driving down. Okay, not a great place to be. Go ahead. But he has a, pardon the pun, death grip on the boat. Okay, go ahead. Still hanging onto the boat. Go ahead. Popped up now. Go ahead. And all smiles. He's all happy. Everything's over, right? Well, not quite. Go ahead. Because we weren't paddling, the current got the boat again. It's now driving it back into the wall of water. Go ahead. Notice how far back it is into the water now. Go ahead. And this is what happens when a boat is forced back into that wall of water in a recirculating or keeper hole. Go ahead. This time they were lucky. It didn't go completely inverted. It happened to spin out of it. Go ahead. But not before we lose one more over here. Okay. The thing to remember here is, okay, this is not an isolated incident. Okay? This is the Deschutes River, and this goes on all day, every day of the rafting season. People run this hole intentionally, and this happens to boats. Okay? Now, this, again, would you back up there? This had a happy ending. Everyone was wearing their life jackets. But I'll ask you to imagine being in this water without a life jacket. Okay? The consequences of a happy ending are not, the likelihood is not very good. Okay? Because you will be driven to the bottom. There's no question. And if you don't know how to get out and are lucky enough to swim out the bottom, this water will just, like a washing machine, it will just recirculate you. Okay? It is deadly. Go ahead. As far as fatalities, these figures are from the Oregon State Marine Board. My apologies to Director Don Hefner here, but when I got these statistics, these are only for whitewater boating fatalities. These don't include bank drownings, fishermen, that sort of thing. These are fatalities in whitewater out of boats, okay? And I found a couple from my own county that I found that were missing. And I think that the number may be slightly higher than this. I don't know that for certain, but I believe that not because of any error on the Marine Board's part, but because of errors in getting the information to them. When I was first appointed as a search and rescue coordinator, I recovered bodies out of that river, and I had no idea that I had a responsibility to report that to the Marine Board. So if they never heard about it, of course they couldn't reflect it in their material. So, but from these that we do have for this period of time, 36 fatalities, 26 were not wearing life jackets, 72%, and the average age in this particular case was 44. Let's talk a little bit about costs, okay? In 2006, we had a horrible year on the Deschutes River. We had 5 drownings just within my county. The Danielle Hagler recovery cost over $50,000, somewhere between $50,000 and $70,000 to our best estimates. That's unusual, but spending $1,000 to $5,000 per recovery is not unusual at all. It costs a lot of money to do this. And the emotional costs, it's not just families that are affected. I have volunteers that are going out and putting themselves in harm's way to go out and get these bodies. And then even after that, sometimes these recoveries are made days, weeks, months after the initial incident, and it's not pretty. And these are volunteers. We provide professional counseling to them, but nothing erases the memories or the mental pictures that they have of those events. It's not a nice thing. And there's an economic loss. Maupin has an economy heavily dependent upon rafting. And every time there's a publicized death on the river, Maupin takes a hit because people stay home. Okay, they're thinking, we don't want to do this. Okay, quickly, current PFD law, current life jacket law for the state of Oregon. Every boat, every piece of water, there must be a life jacket, one life jacket on board for every person on board. Okay, if you're 12 and under, it must be on. You don't have to be wearing them unless you're 12 and under. It has to be one in the boat for every person.
Could I remind you to keep with the microphone range there?
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
10 to 1. Thank you, Madam Chair. Current law for guided boats, okay? Guided boats, whitewater rivers, it simply says the guide and all passengers, if they are in Class 3 and above rapids, okay, not anywhere on the river, but in Class 3 and above rapids, if you're with a guide, you have to have a proper whitewater jacket and it has to be on. That's the law currently for guided boats. Also, currently, the law for personal watercraft, jet skis. Okay, there's an inherent risk if you're riding a jet ski that you may fall off and be in the water. So the law says you must be wearing a life jacket. Well, jet skis are normally ridden where? Out on fairly flat, calm water. So compare that to the water you've just seen, okay, and ask yourself, should you also be wearing a life jacket in that water? Okay, go ahead. Changing it just makes sense. Look at it this way. Okay. If we make you as absolutely safe as we can, we put you with a guide, he's got the right equipment, he has the knowledge, he has the training, he can keep you out of trouble. If you get in trouble, he can get you out of trouble. If we do all of that, then you have to wear your life jacket. That's the law. Okay? But this is your first trip ever down the river. You don't know a thing about whitewater. You're in your brand new $20 Kmart boat. Okay? Then all you have to do is take this and throw it in the bottom of the boat. You don't even have to put it on. And you're legal. You're good to go. Class 3s, 4s, 5s, whatever. Committee, if that makes sense to you, tell me what I'm missing. Because it doesn't make sense to me. Okay, we need to change the law. Proposed law, all it does is mirror the guided law and say, we don't care if you're with a guide or not. If you're in a Class 3 rapid and above, everyone in the boat needs to have a proper white water jacket on. Simple as that. Guided or not. Okay? Go ahead. Why do we need enforcement? Well, you know, it's no secret that life jackets save lives. We've all known that for years and years and years. And I keep pulling bodies out of the river without life jackets. Okay? some people will not comply without the threat of enforcement. Okay? Just like seatbelts and like motorcycle helmets, okay? Some people aren't going to use them if there isn't enforcement. My Marine job is part-time, okay? 6 months out of the year, I'm a Marine cop, and 6 months out of the year, I'm on the road. Sometimes when I'm out on patrol, I'll pull up to an intersection, maybe a four-way, okay? And I look across, and I see the folks in the car facing me do this, put on their seatbelt, okay? Now, they didn't just suddenly realize how much safer they'd be. They saw a cop, and they were afraid they were going to get a ticket. Okay? Either way, they're safer now, okay? And it's the threat of enforcement that made it work. Also, as to enforceability, I and all the other Marine officers around the state, I can't be everywhere all the time. I have a lot of water patrol, okay? But I can be at Boxcar Rapid now, and I can be at Wapanesha 2 hours from now, and I can be at Rattlesnake next week, okay? And you don't know when you come down there where or when you're going to see me, okay? Just the same as on the road, okay? It is enforceable by current staff. Go ahead. The only negative comment that I've heard so far about this whole issue is one of, well, I should be able to take chances if I want to, okay? It's a matter of personal freedoms. And I'll be the first to tell you that I strongly support your and my personal freedoms, okay? But in this particular case, well, in every case, my freedoms stop where they touch you. When my freedoms impact you, that's where they stop. And in this case, the cost to society, the cost to families, to search and rescue members, to business people, to taxpayers, all of those costs far outweigh the slight infringement on personal rights that we're asking for. We require the use of seatbelts in cars and helmets on motorcycles because the consequences of not doing so are too great. They are unreasonable and unacceptable to society as a whole. Okay? And there's no difference here. The requirement to wear a proper life jacket in a Class 3 and above rapid is a reasonable and prudent thing to do. And to not require it is, in my opinion, akin to saying you have to have seat belts in your car, but you don't have to wear them. We're saying exactly the same thing. Okay? I spent the last 3 years working on this, and I've talked to a lot of people. And this change is supported by river guides, rental operators, Lynette Ripley, the BLM Lower Deschutes River Manager, other BLM rangers and enforcement officers, every Marine officer that I've talked to, city and county leaders, Paul Don Hefner, who is here with us today, State Senator Ted Ferrioli, State Representative John Huffman, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, who voted unanimously to endorse this bill, Deschutes River managers, including Oregon Parks and Rec, BLM, Warm Springs, ODFW, OSP, Bureau of Indian Affairs, and local governments, including the counties of Wasco, Sherman, Jefferson, and the cities of Maupin, The Dalles, and Madras. We have very nearly absolute universal support for this, and why? Because it makes sense. I thank you, Madam Chair and Committee, for your time, and I'd be welcome to answer your questions. We do have some other people that would like to address you in support of this measure.
And we definitely want to hear from them. Are there any pressing questions for the Sheriff right now? Not, Mr. Brown, did you have anything additional to add?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I am Billy Brown. I'm the lead river ranger for the Prineville Bureau of Land Management, working primarily on the Lower Deschutes River. I'm here to testify on behalf of my immediate supervisor, Lynette Ripley, who is the river manager, and together we operate the federal government's end of the largest river program in the country. To give you some perspective, I'd like to tell you a little bit about my background first. I started running whitewater in the early 1980s with my family, right when this sport was first becoming popular as a recreational pastime. And after serving in the military, I began guiding professionally in 1994. And I have been a river ranger for coming up on my fifth season now. Eight of those years guiding professionally were as a Class 5 expert whitewater guide, and I have guided 21 rivers in five different countries. We have 150,000 people per year come down just the Deschutes, and the scenario that Deputy Pierce was describing with people not wearing their life jackets, typically with a paddle in one hand and a beer in the other, falling out of the boat, happens not only every day, it happens multiple times every day on every whitewater river in this state. We do have education and information initiatives in place, such as signs. We contact people personally, but people typically don't read the signs, and even when we do contact them personally, they tend to ignore us, put their life jacket back in the bottom of the boat, and carry on. So I just want to impress upon the committee that part of my job is to pull people out of the river. I've had to perform several life or death situational swift water rescues and several or I should say countless minor ones. It is certainly the worst part of my job to have to tell someone that their loved one didn't make it, and the more that we can keep that from happening, the better. I also want to just say that BLM and everyone on our staff wholeheartedly supports this legislation. It will save lives. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? All right. Thank you, gentlemen. That was a very impressive presentation. I appreciate your time and your travel here.
Madam Chair, do you have the time for our other two
Absolutely.
Witnesses
I'm
to
about
speak?
To call them up.
I apologize.
No problem. We have here also Sherry Holliday and Mark Angel, or is that correct?
Yes.
Or if not, you can correct me if you'd like to come forward. And to you also, thank you for traveling over here today. I know you've all come from some distance.
We did. Thank you for allowing us this time. Well, obviously, my name's Sherry. He's Mark.
Well, if you could give us your full name just into the microphone for the record, we'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Sherry Holliday, Wasco County Commissioner.
Thank you.
Actually, I'm wearing three hats today. I am a Wasco County Commissioner. I'm also the manager of the Southern Wasco County Ambulance Service based out of Maupin. And I'm also a member of the Deschutes River Managers Committee. When you saw the slide that listed all the agencies that were a part of that committee, I'm the local government representative who represents the counties and the cities. So I've been involved with the Deschutes River for a long time and with the ambulance for about 28 years now, both as an EMT and as the general manager. So I have also responded to incidents where the drownings have happened and the families there, and you know, we come up on the scene, a bunch of volunteers, and we ask our people to deal with this and have to talk with the family right there on the side of the road, and it's very, very difficult. It's difficult for recruitment of volunteers and for retention of the ones that you have. So I think, you know, that's a huge issue to us when it's so hard to draw from. We have a small base of people. I mean, you know, we have less than 400 people that live in the city of Maupin, and it's hard to find volunteers, and when they're faced with those kind of issues, it makes it even harder. So I think that, you know, that's an important point that I really don't want you guys to miss. The economics of it to the small cities that I represent, and particularly the city of Maupin, because we're right in the middle of what they call the splash and giggle section of the Deschutes River, which means that this is where everybody comes to have fun, and it is fun. And, you know, and we're grateful for the economics that it brings to the city of Maupin, because, as many of you may know, we used to have a lumber mill which closed down, and that was all we had. So this visitor industry has really been a boom to the city of Maupin. In 2006, when we had the five drownings, most of them happened before the 1st of July. And the middle of July, the phone just quit ringing. I mean, the businesses, there was nothing. it had gotten to the press, of course, you know, and people were not only not calling to make reservations, but they were calling to cancel reservations. So that summer was terrible. Last year, we recovered a little bit, although the businesses that I talked to said they were still about 30% down from their normal. So, you know, part of that could have been the gas crunch, could have been probably many things, but I think part of it was still from the drownings that had happened and the scare that it had put into people. So wearing a life jacket that would have saved a life definitely would help there. And I guess as far as my role as the Deschutes River Management, Deputy Pierce made the presentation to both the working group and the managers committee and received full support. I think Director Don Hefner was not there, as he is a member of the committee also. So he wasn't there at the presentation, but the rest of the entities that were there did vote to support Deputy Pierce's bill. And I personally think it's very important. And I guess I just want to close and let you know that, as you can tell by listening from Deputy Pierce, and this is an issue that's very dear to his heart. I want you to know that the deputy's worked for the county for many, many years. We think he's a man of great integrity, and all he wants is to save a life. He has no hidden agenda. So I'm proud to drive to Salem with him and be able to present my side of it. So that's all I have. If you don't have any questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions? I appreciate your comments about the recruitment and retention of volunteers who are faced with these kinds of situations. It's a former life of mine, and I can really empathize with that. But I think that's a very important point to bring out, is the impact on people. And there are others on this panel who are responders, and we can empathize with that. It's a good point to make. Thank you very much for making it.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Mark Angel. I'm from Redmond, Oregon. I own what's called Whitewater Salvage. It's a private concern. I'm the only person designated by BLM to take to salvage on the Deschutes River or the John Day River. They give me virtually an open hand. I can take my power boat or any boat I want or any vehicle I want any time that I designate it an emergency to go any place and take care of a problem. I'm going to have to read the rest of this.
It's fine.
I'm going to make two statements to you, and I can make both of these statements without feeling even the slightest bit boastful. Number one is I am the only whitewater salvage diver that has ever lived on this planet. Number two, I understand and can deal with river and whitewater currents and can deal with river and whitewater tragedies better by a very wide margin than any other person that has ever lived. The life jacket mandates in this bill are exactly what I have been preaching to anybody that would listen for over 3 decades. For many years, maybe 10, I have put up a whitewater self-safe boating exhibit near Maupin on the Deschutes River. These mandates are the focal point of that exhibit, and have always been. Roger Pierce did not come up with this idea. I did not come up with this idea. This idea was considered the common sense safe boating practices long before either of us ever showed up on the scene. I can't thank Roger Pierce enough for running the gauntlet it took to get this bill before you. The things I have told you have put my life in a bad predicament, and I'm hoping you can help. When a parent knocks at my door, crying their heart out, and asks me if I would go find their kid in the river, I know that if I don't go, nobody else can do it. And if I don't go, there's a good chance that body might never be recovered. The person before me and anyone else that cared for that victim will live a life scarred with the added agonies that come without closure. So for me, no has never been an option. I don't charge, nor will I accept any money from the friends, from the family, or the friends of the victim, not even expenses. Since I don't belong to any government organization, the continual rising cost of helping is an expense that I pay out of my own shallow pockets. I'm going to stop right there when I'm reading it. I cannot belong to any search and rescue. The reason is that they have insurance and they can't dive that kind of water. And the liability to their counties is something that they can't do. And the way this works is I get a phone call. Search and rescue units are really good at what they do, but they have their limitations. And they find most of the bodies, but when they can't, or it's in a place that they can't go, they call me. They don't ask me if I'll come and help. BLM calls me. They don't ask me if I'll come and help. They know just to tell me there's a problem, because I know I need to go. And I go and help. It's as simple as that. That way they're not liable. They're not putting their organization in harm's way. And we get the job done. For me, some years are more demanding than others. In one calendar year alone, I spent 31 days just looking for bodies. Now you add that to an even greater number of days that I spend each and every year salvaging dangerous obstructions from the rapids, mostly power boats and drift boats, and the expense is almost unbearable. So, almost in self-defense, I started educating boaters with the exhibit and other ways. I will never know how much money that expensive exhibit saves me each year, or how much work it saves me. I just know for me, it's a great investment. You will never know how many lives you have saved when you pass this bill, but I will. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, sir. Questions? Again, we very much appreciate your passion.
Thank you.
And your willingness to come and talk to us about this. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representing.
May I interject? Would it be okay if I ask Deputy Pierce to come back up for just a moment?
We do have one more individual signed up to testify.
Oh, okay.
And then we'll try to get that in, okay? Paul Don Hefner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Don Hefner, Director of the Marine Board. House Bill 2079, as you've heard, would require the general public to wear an approved life jacket when boating in Class 3 Whitewater. 2005, the legislature adopted a parallel measure that required this for outfitters and guides, as you've heard. Since that, the passage of that, compliance on the outfitter guide side has been good. There have been virtually no reports of problems with that law. And wearing a life jacket on any water is something we always recommend. Class 3 whitewater poses special risks, so wearing a PFD or a life jacket on this type of water is really a must. During the past 10 years, there were 42 boating fatalities on all Oregon rivers. And of those, 12 occurred on Class 3 or higher rapids. In 6 of the 12, the victim was correctly wearing a life jacket. In the 7th, it was worn, but worn improperly. So in slightly more than half the deaths that took place in Class 3 or higher, a life jacket was worn or present on the victim. And we believe most people recognize the inherent danger and risk associated with running whitewater rivers, especially those with Class 3 rapids. Overall, 12% of the river deaths were associated with a person not wearing a PFD in Class 3 and higher rapids. This bill would provide a consistent law for the public that life jackets must be worn in Class 3 rapids, whether the trip's a commercial trip or a private trip. The fact is that in any water, moving or not, is hazardous water. We know that life jackets save lives, but only if they're worn. In whitewater situations, whether Class 3 or not, the margin for error is extremely low. As our accident statistics show, even wearing a life jacket is no guarantee of survival. However, without a life jacket being worn, the chances of surviving a mishap are almost nil. A universal mandatory life jacket wear is one of the few safety interventions remaining that hasn't been adopted to reduce boating deaths, and I don't think we're at that doorstep today. However, adopting House Bill 2079 would be a small step moving forward by mandating PFD wear in Class 3 whitewater and making it consistent for both commercial and non-commercial boaters. And I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Any questions for the director? Yes, Representative Widener.
It's something for basically all of the officers that are here today. So as someone who boats a lot and does a lot of water skiing, I would appreciate if you keep silent the 13 and above for the life jackets, because in my boat it's 16 and above. And as the gentleman testified earlier about common sense, when John first mentioned this to me, I figured this was a no-brainer and it was something that was already a law. And I think it's something we need to expedite and address rather quickly, so because there's no reason for this.
Thank you. All right, if there's no further questions, again, we thank you for your time here today. And Sheriff Pierce, I think you were asked to return for just a moment, if you would, please. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Deputy Pierce, just for some clarification, and Paul, thank you for coming, and he kind of addressed this again, but there's some information out that I'd just like to clarify. This is for all waterways, Class 3 rapids and above. Is that correct, or
Madam
just
Chair,
specified rivers?
Okay, Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, the law would apply to all waters in the state of Oregon, but only Class 3 and above rapids on those waters. I guess the question that I have seen is, well, what if the river has sections that are Class 3 and sections that are Class 1? Do we need to wear the life jacket all the time? And the answer is no. Okay, the law would mirror that of the guides law, which currently says if you are in a Class 3 or above, then you must be wearing your jacket. And that's the intent of the law, is to mirror that. Just make it apply to everyone, not just those on guided boats.
One follow-up? We've never discussed this, but just to alleviate any concern, do you have any intention of this bill, House Bill 2079, to be a precursor to anything else? Do you have any other intentions of presenting something in another legislative session to mandate something additional and further? Is this a step one to something else?
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, the answer to that is unequivocally no. I've been working on this for 3 years. God willing, I get to retire this year or next. If this bill is passed, I can tell you that I will consider this the greatest accomplishment of my law enforcement career.
Thank you. Representative Matthews, go ahead.
Thank you. Deputy Pierce, I just want to say, you and Mr. Angel, you as well, and the whole group, thank you. Your community is much safer as a result of you. Thanks for your dedication. I had a question, and Representative Huffman kind of he touched on it a little bit, but as I'm thinking about, a lot of these tragedies, first of all, they can be prevented by life jackets, and I get that. But second of all, if some of these folks are with guides, is there a responsibility of those guides now to make sure they're in those jackets? And understanding most of them are operating legitimately, but in the case where a guide, it's got to be frustrating to you if somebody's on with a guide and they're not wearing their life vest now. Do you see a penalty in place for law enforcement to maybe hold somebody a little more accountable if they're in that guide capacity and they don't assist us with enforcing this law?
Madam Chair, Representative Matthews, that is an issue, and I do believe that guides should be held to a higher standard. However, there is a situation currently in place under the guided law where it is the guide that gets the ticket and not the individual if there are people on that boat not wearing their life jacket. And that can present a problem. If you're halfway down a river and you have a client that decides, I'm not going to wear it, what are you going to do? There's nothing that the guide can do. You can't set him off on the shore and expect him to walk out, and yet the guide gets the ticket. In our seatbelt laws, if you as a passenger don't wear your seatbelt, I'm going to give you the ticket, okay? And it should be the same way. There should be personal responsibility on the boat. So I hope that answers your question. I do believe that guides should be held to a higher standard, but they already are. They're required to have knowledge of the river. They're required to have certain equipment. They're required to know first aid. They're required to have been through a particular stretch of water prior to ever taking anybody through that section of water for hire. So I believe there are those standards, and there are fairly stiff penalties for violating those standards.
Thank you.
Actually, that leads me to a question.
Yes, Madam Chair.
I'm thinking about the stretches that you described of several days trip, and so you're obviously paddling through a lot of quiet water where the wearing of the personal flotation device wouldn't be required. So I assume that because a guide knows the river, they sort of stop in the quiet pool for a moment and say, everybody put on your life jackets because there's a rapid coming up. Now, if I have one of those new devices that I just bought at Kmart, and I go down this river for wherever they buy them, I don't know why that particular thing came to me, but I don't know the river. How am I going to know where I'm supposed to put on my life jacket and where I'll go? I can tell you where I put it on, but we'll just use that.
Okay, using that as an example, Madam Chair, I believe this is where education will play a major role. The Oregon State Marine Board has been very cooperative in putting up appropriate signage in cooperation with BLM and appropriate counties, and it would be my first intention to work with the Oregon State Marine Board to put up proper signage within my county that will educate boaters, first of all, to the new law, that there is a law now in effect, and to where those rapids are. In the presentation, you saw what was described as Wapanisha Rapid, and that rapid has claimed more lives than any other rapid on the Deschutes River. Mm-hmm. And the normal put-in or take-off place in the Splash and Giggle section is just above that rapid. It's called Harpham Flat. You put in your boat, and it's nice, easy, Class 1 water. You go around the corner, and it's, oh, my God. And you're staring at Wapanisha Rapid, okay? And if you haven't put your jacket on by now, it's too late. It's a problem. So we would want to have the signage up at the most logical place at the put-in and at other appropriate locations on the river.
Thank you very much. And I guess I have promoted you to sheriff. You might want to
offer my apologies to
the sheriff. But I thank you, sir, for coming. In case before retirement you want to step up, there you go. So,
thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you all very much for your time. And with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2079. We are adjourned, I believe. Is there any...